Test. This is Dave Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute, and today we're continuing our series of interviews. This is June 21st, 1988, and today we're continuing our series of interviews with Mr. Roy W. Chapin, Jr., former chairman of American Motors and a longtime automobile man following in his father's footsteps, Roy Chapin, Sr. Today we'd like to ask Mr. Chapin to tell us a little bit about the 60s and with the departure of George Romney and with the eventual ascension of Mr. Chapin to the chairmanship of AMC, we'd like to take a look at the decade of the 60s from his point of view. And first off, Mr. Chapin, I'd like to ask you, things were tough in the early 60s for AMC. You'd lost at one point, I think, about 75.8 million, I read somewhere. And you needed desperately needed a change of image. But before we get into that, what would be your thumbnail assessment of the Romney years? You certainly worked with him fairly closely.
They were exceptional years in many ways because just to make this concise, George took over in the fall of '54 after when George Mason was the architect of the American Motors merger of Nash and Hudson. Died very unexpectedly, and it was it was quite a wrench because many of the people in the company were people that Mason had brought in, and George was the champion of the small car. George Romney was the champion of the small car, and he was convinced that he had to have people who believed in the small car, which in this case was the Rambler, which really was initiated by Mason, and so. And it turned out, of course, that Romney was absolutely right. And we, bit by bit, after digesting the merger in the late 50s, we went almost exclusively into the concentration on the then what became known as the compact car, the Rambler.
Yes.
Now, we still continued with the Nash model. Models or American Motors models, I guess I should say at that time, with bigger cars. But the emphasis was definitely on the Rambler, and it turned out to be an extremely fortuitous and timely thing because it was we achieved some for those days relatively spectacular volumes. We made very good money, and then about 1961 or two, as I recall it, George decided he was. Interested in becoming the governor of the state of Michigan. He'd always been extremely interested and active in politics. And so I believe it was 62 that he left to become governor of Michigan. And at that time.
Was there any internal dismay at his leaving at that time, do you recall?
Well, yeah, there was concern because George was a very visible leader. And a wonderful, you know, he's a wonderful man and a dynamic personality. And he was sort of Mr. American Motors, which has been repeated since by others, sort of, in other companies. Anyway, there was concern, but I think by that time the organization was pretty well put together with the same objective, the same understanding. And Roy Abernathy, who had been brought in by Romney, actually, from Kaiser Fraser because he was a, quote, small car man, was the sales and marketing vice president, and was a very logical successor. Dick Cross, Roy became the president. Dick Cross became chairman. Dick was our counsel. He's a prominent Detroit lawyer and a delightful man who was a great friend. Richard E. Cross. And he was Cross, Rock, Miller, Beeson, and I don't know who all now. Mm-hmm. But he's still of counsel to that law firm here in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But he was an excellent man for the position. My feeling always was that Dick is not an automobile man and he made no commitment he was going to work 7 days a week, but he spent a lot more time at it than, frankly, I was surprised how much time and effort he put into it, but I always had a sort of a feeling that maybe George was kind of keeping his eye on that seat as chairman, just in case he didn't make it, or he was not elected governor of Michigan. Well, as it turned out, of course, he was. And Dick handled his position very well. Abernathy really was the guy that ran the company. And at that time, I was, well, I don't remember now. I think I was the chief financial officer.
You were vice president and treasurer.
Vice president and treasurer.
And then later, executive vice president.
And then subsequently, about that period, executive vice president. Then I think it was about 62 that I took over the international operations.
Oh, did you?
Giving up, I gave up the, we had a strange situation that had grown out of people. You often design jobs to fit people.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our chief financial officer was also in charge of all the international operations, which were primarily Kelvinator, the appliance business. But decided that it had to be split. And I was sort of given the choice between, did I want to run the financial end of it, or did I want to see what I could do with the international end? Mm-hmm. And I frankly thought the international sounded a lot more exciting, although the financial end was plenty exciting because keeping the cash coming in faster than it was going out was quite an undertaking. So that's basically that's about as quick a sketch as I can give you of the Romney exit period and her and the people that sort of took over for him.
What about Abernathy? Was he a pretty good executive?
He was a wonderful sales manager, mm-hmm. and yes, he was a good executive.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man who had a great rapport with the dealer organization, which was very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he didn't have a very good rapport with the fellow who succeeded Cross as chairman, namely Robert Beverly Evans.
We'll get to him in a moment.
Okay,
I want to get your reaction
but,
to him.
Roy was a gentleman at heart. He had a very forceful manner.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a natural born salesman. He was a Packard dealer for years in I think Hartford,
mm-hmm.
and in other words, he knew the automobile business right from the retail level on up.
That's wonderful. You've had a history, I think, over in the last 20 years or so, of promoting the salespeople to the top job, because obviously the key to American Motor success is sales and dealer.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm not sure I would agree with that because starting with the 1967, I guess, when when Muhnenberg and I took over,
yeah.
He was strictly a manufacturing guy.
That's true.
And a wonderful one. And I had a lot of different kinds of experiences, but I guess basically I was a salesman too in that respect. Later on, we'll discuss that as you get to it chronologically. But
mm-hmm.
in other words, it wasn't purely the fellow that really ultimately succeeded Luneberg and me was a manufacturing man also,
mm-hmm.
Jerry Myers.
Right. Of interest to me, and I hope to other people, is that in the 60s, someone thought you needed a sporty image. You seemed to be a bit mired in the sensible small car image, and someone felt, especially Dick Teague and others. Dick Teague, of course, Richard Teague was your director of styling. And do you remember any impacting on any of those events?
No, I am very well, because it was an obvious need at the time for us to have some method of having people start to. People still didn't know what American Motors was or who American Motors was.
Yeah.
They knew about Rambler, and Rambler, while it was our mainstay and our godsend and our lifeblood for quite a few years, had developed a reputation of being just sort of a good, substantial, inexpensive,
economical, sensible
piece of transportation, which is all of which it was. To be a successful company, we figured we had to do more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Javelin was really Dick Teague's inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
It was tremendously effective in doing what we wanted to do, which was first of all to convince the dealer organization that we could do something more than build a little pedestrian kind of an automobile,
mm-hmm.
and secondly, to give us something that we could use in our, particularly in this case, in television, and well, for that matter, magazine too, in the advertising and promotional aspects of it. Now, one of the reasons that we, well, two things made the Javelin, helped the Javelin do its job. First, it was a good-looking, up-to-the-minute, good-taste automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it, with a little tinkering here and there, could really perform.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, we entered it in the sports SCCA racing, the road racing, you might guess you'd call it. And third, it lent itself to dramatic TV stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to make that third aspect of it really register, is when we decided we were going to move from one advertising agency to the then very controversial Mary Wells, the Wells Rich Green Company.
Which one had you dropped? Was it local? Or
I know it was a New York agency, and for the moment it escapes my mind. It was a very big agency. They did a fine commercial job, you'd
mm-hmm.
say. But I was looking at this now was a period when I had to make the decision, and I felt we had to have somebody that would be absolutely dramatic as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And Wells Rich had that reputation and that capability. They knew nothing about automobiles,
mm-hmm.
and there are a wealth of fascinating stories on that score, but that's, we don't have time for that. But they did some really memorable TV stuff, which again I could I still remember them, and I think a lot of other people do. And they also did a.
Remember one particular?
Well, they had one particular one. A fellow drove up, and he was so proud of his Javelin, and some guy next to him wanted to race him at the stoplight, and then he leaned over and said, "No, sorry, goldfish." And he had pretended he had a bowl of goldfish with him because he didn't want to tear up his automobile. And then he takes it to a garage, a parking garage, turns it over to the attendant, and you hear this scream of tires, this roar of engines as the attendant charges up the ramp in this car. Wells Rich had a capacity for hiring actors or hiring people in there that were just priceless. I mean, it was as good as going to a movie sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, they did a very controversial magazine thing, which was very effective, where they did a comparison between the Javelin and the Mustang. The Mustang was a very hot vehicle at that time. And I got some, I had some discussions, let's say, with Mr. Henry Ford on the subject, and I pointed out to him that it was all positive. We just had nothing anywhere in it said anything bad about the Mustang. It just said the Javelin is better because on this count and this count and this count and this count. And it raised some hackles, but it also got a lot of attention. And
good conversations at the Droid Club, I suspect.
I heard about it from various people.
Yeah.
And but the interesting thing was, not long after that, Lincoln Mercury did a similar one with, I believe it, they used Oldsmobile as their as the other.
Oh, really?
Comparison. Yeah. Which, so it's these things. We just happened to have done the first, or Wells Rich did the first, and they were really one of the first to do what you might call entertaining commercials,
mm-hmm.
that were attention grabbers.
Did you get to know Mary Wells and her husband?
Yes, I knew them both quite
delightful,
well.
Delightful, dynamic
yeah.
people.
Yeah, they're wonderful. Mm-hmm. And Mary used to show up we'd have these advertising meetings in the offices, and she'd
mm-hmm.
come in occasionally, and she always made a dramatic entrance, and she always had something to say about it, and she's a fantastic woman.
She's still going strong, I think, yeah. I think she
bought
her husband out, and I think she ran it herself.
Yeah, well, I don't think Harding Lawrence ever really had much of a piece of the company.
Yeah.
He was too busy running Braniff at that time.
That's right, he was.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's where those wonderfully colored airplanes came into view.
That was partly Mary's idea.
That's
you
right.
know, the colored airplanes, and then the thing they had all their what we call them now, attendants, stewardesses, change their clothes about every 2 hours or something like that. It's called the airstrip. That's the kind of, you know, if you want to stop people and get their, make them pay attention, they may not like it or disagree or agree with you in the long run, but that was what we were looking for, and we got it.
Flair, yes.
In terms of getting attention to, and we had the automobile you could do it with.
Yes, you did, with
because,
the javelin.
Because the javelin just cleaned up in the SCCA races.
Now, somewhere along this line, this baleful figure that you mentioned, Robert Beverly Evans, posed on the scene. How did that happen?
I don't know about that baleful stuff. Robert Beverly is one of the most delightful people you ever met.
Right,
and he's also one of my oldest friends.
But he wasn't too good for American Motors.
Well, he saved the day
at
one point, yes. In May of, or whenever the annual meeting was, there wasn't, Romney was ill or something. He didn't come to the meeting. He couldn't. I think he had appendicitis. He had something, and Cross was casting about for something to say at the meeting that was anything but extremely depressing. And he finally made me get up and make a presentation on the international activities, which had happened that we were doing extremely well. But you know, you can pad a meeting about so long, and Evans anyway let it drop that he had bought 200 and some odd thousand shares of American Motors. And I'll tell you that. That was the greatest boon at that particular moment, that anybody had that kind of confidence in the company that could have happened.
It was 66.
Was that when it was? Yeah.
Did he want to become chairman? Did he ever express
Yeah, and he was chairman.
And he was chairman for about 3 or 4
and
2 years.
Well, he came in April, and I think I became chairman in January of 67, so he was chairman through until then.
66. Teague mentioned somewhere that he thought Evans was a shot in the arm as far as the AMX Javelin program was.
I'm sure he was.
He felt that this was something they should pursue because he's exactly what you needed.
Yeah. Well, he wanted, he's a guy who has a million ideas, and if one out of 50 is feasible, they're usually good enough so it's worth listening to the other 49. And I know, he used to drive Abernathy nuts because Abernathy was a absolutely very, he was a right down the road kind of a guy on all the years of automotive experience, and Evans had none. And Evans would come in and give him all these suggestions as to what you ought to do. And
that's what I meant by baleful. He was he was a non-automotive person who impacted on the
he really kept the pot stirred. I'll say that for him. It was great.
It was exciting. You enjoyed working with
him.
You about this time you had a Vignali AMX made a prototype, and you'd also done a prototype javelin. This is in the late 60s, and apparently Evans and Teague, with your concurrence, I'm sure, pushed this into a racing program that was startlingly successful.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'd forgotten about the Vignali had any part of it, but the basic javelin with modifications, and we had Roger Penske.
You
couldn't have picked a better person there either, and he picked. He had about half a dozen drivers: Mark Donahue and Peter. What was his last name? And a guy named Skip Scott, and so on. Who were they were sort of wild men, but boy, they knew how to drive automobiles. And I remember just one little anecdote. I went to the, because this relates to something that was important. I went to Watkins Glen to see the road race there. It was the first time the javelins had really appeared in force in public. Mm-hmm. And we had a tent. We must have had 150 dealers there. And I know they came from all over the country, all over the East anyhow. And we gave away those. We had jackets, red, white, and blue jackets. Mm-hmm. And we gave those away. And I tell you, I knew a lot of those dealers, and I went into that tent, and there were some of those fellows in there with tears running down their cheeks. This is the first time they'd ever seen this kind of a excitement, because the javelins, most of them, they didn't know whether the javelins were winning, losing, or what. But you saw these red, white, and blue cars out there just tearing up that road track, and doing extremely well, and they sounded great, and they just looked great. I tell you, it did more for dealer morale. Just the mere fact that they were there, and I don't even, frankly, I don't remember whether we won the race or not, and it didn't seem to me, didn't make a damn bit of difference.
No, it was the publicity, yeah. Right. Well, you did very well. You came up with some key victories in the late 60s. And then money was very short. In fact, you were losing millions. And
true.
So you and Bill Lundeberg decided to take over. How did that work? How did that work?
Well, the board made the decision.
Yeah, right.
And
now Bill had come from
Ford,
uh-huh.
And he had run major plant. He ran the Rouge plant, mm-hmm. and he ran the big St. Louis defense plant. And
well, he was a manufacturing man.
And well, he was a finance man, really. Down underneath, he did a lot of financial analysis work at Ford, but he was also a hell of a manufacturing man. More than that, he was a tremendous people man. He,
mm-hmm.
he was very strict and very, boy, this is how it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But and he could take you apart limb by limb and put you back together again, and you'd love it when you get all done after you get over nursing your wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a perfectly remarkable man.
Did you work together as a team well?
Yeah, he was the vice president of manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
when I was speaking now, I think it's January 1967,
mm-hmm.
I was the executive vice president in charge of the automotive division.
Was there any problem with getting Abernathy and Evans to step aside?
Well, it wasn't exactly a joyful meeting, no.
You were present, I think.
Well, I was asked to leave the room.
Asked to leave the room.
I mean, obviously, I didn't vote on it.
Mm, of course.
And then some key members of the board just decided that they... In fact, I have to admit, it came as a bit of a surprise to both Bill and me. We thought, you know, well, I should say I thought that at some point it might happen, but I didn't think it was going to happen that probably. Well, one of the problems was that we really were just plain out of money.
Yes.
And
we were 75.8 million.
Well, and we more importantly, we didn't have any cash.
Yeah.
As was in order to try to come up with a good 66 calendar year, a lot of cars were built in December and did not get shipped.
Mm-hmm.
We had a staggering inventory, and you can't eat inventory. So I know when Bill and I came in, which is around the 7th or 8th of January, as I remember it, but whatever it was, well, there was real concern as to whether we could meet the payroll on the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's February?
January.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
And but the first thing we did was to hop on the plane and go to New York and gather our bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And I could spend about another hour telling you about that experience.
Basically, but how did they react? They didn't want you to go under, obviously.
Well, that was, of course, the thing that saved us.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want any part of lending us any more money, and we went through the first day, and we weren't getting any. Well, I'll make this quick, but it's pretty interesting.
Please do.
At least I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of human interest in it.
Yeah.
And we got to the point where, God, we'd worked all day long and well into the night, and then everybody was just mad at everybody, and I said, come on, knock it off. So we went back to the Plaza Hotel, and we had our finance vice president, and our treasurer, and Lundeberg, and me, and our controller, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and we had gotten absolutely nowhere the first day with these bankers. They were just saying,
was it
well,
a consortium, or was it one?
Yeah, we had a credit agreement, and this was a group of banks in the credit agreement, which Chase Bank was the lead bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, Lundeberg had actually...
What were they counseling? Were they counseling shutting down?
Well, they just said, you solved your problem, you know, you're not going to get any money out of us, that
right.
kind of thing. You know, well, I've been through that a few times, and at some point they realized the facts of life.
Yeah.
In fact, Lundeberg made a magnificent gesture. He had a short fuse. He was listening to all this stuff about, well, you've cut us, got this and that and so on. You got yourself into this, you get yourself out and so on. And he finally got up and he took a bunch of keys out of his pocket and he said, there are the keys to the plant. Who wants them? And I said, help me. And boy, that was dead silence. Well, anyway, we went back to the hotel and we sat around and I said, look, we're getting nowhere. So let's think of a new approach. But we couldn't really come up with an entirely new approach. But we got a new angle. I said, okay, we're all through the meeting. We're going down to Trader Vic's and have dinner. We went down there and let me get rid of this. We had dinner and a typical Trader Vic dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And after which they always give you those fortune cookies. And everybody was sort of half depressed and everybody had a drink or two and they were just beginning to feel sorry for themselves. And finally I said, well, listen to this. And I opened my fortune cookie, I had opened it, and it said, have cash, can travel. So help me. So I read it to him, and the next day we got $20 million.
That was an omen, for sure.
Yeah, but I just thought it was really, and I'll tell you, the fellows that, in fact, I met a fellow on the plane coming back from Norway yesterday, who was our vice president of finance at the time, and he said, "You remember remember the evening in the Plaza Hotel at Trader Vic's?" It impressed a lot of people. Anyway, fortunately, we then embarked on a program of getting rid of that inventory, which is another long story.
But we did it very successfully. Well, there's an article I was reading this morning, and the author says, as soon as Mr. Chapin settled into the new position, he informed his close friend H. Henry Ford II of his intention to go talent hunting at Ford Motor Company. That wouldn't do you any good, Ford had responded. Not many Ford executives would leave Durban to head for Plymouth Road. And besides, the man AMC really needed had left the Ford Company in '63 to operate a private consulting service. Chapin was quick to heed good advice, and shortly thereafter, Victor G. Raviolo had joined AMC as first group vice president in charge of auto engineering, research, styling, and product planning.
What is that you're reading from?
This is from
Automotive Quarterly.
Automotive Quarterly.
Oh, well, I guess I don't read the
Behind the Scenes at AMC with the AMX and the Jamba Bob Ackerson.
What year was that?
This is '81.
Oh, really? Well,
did that essentially take place?
That's essentially true. Yeah. Well, Henry, in fact, he recommended Vic, and he was a tremendous boost to us because he really knew the business.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a very strong personality also.
Oh, does he? No.
And he made major contributions, no question about it. But I think it was he was only with us, I think, about 2 years, if mm-hmm. I remember. Perhaps three.
What happened?
Well, it was his decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he felt that maybe Bill and I were too personally involved in the product design and the decisions and so on. And I think he was more used to having at least a free hand at the point where it turns over to the executive committee or something like that. And we were day-by-day kinds of, I think he felt we were, he never told me this. Mm-hmm. And we parted friends, and as I said, I have tremendous respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
It is his decision to leave, and by that time I think we had what we really needed on the road, meaning in terms of design and development.
The article goes on to say that he put together a committee including Carl Chuck Makian, Bob Jensen, George Cody, and Jim Alexander, and out of this came the Javelin team for the Trans Am Racing season. And he also picked up a gentleman named Craig Breedlove, who helped you very early in the day, and he said the first thing that Chuck Makian did was to call up Torrance, California, and ask for the phone number of Craig Breedlove.
Yeah.
How did that work out fairly well?
Yes, he was another spectacular kind of a fellow, which all added to the total package.
Yeah.
And he had set a world speed record or something. I don't know whether it was on a bicycle or what it was, but I've sort of forgotten the background. But we had a couple of meetings in California, and he drove some of the dealers around in a Javelin and scared the pants off them.
Right.
And I liked him. He was a great guy. And frankly, I don't know what happened to him.
Mm-hmm. But these people, Raviola's committee and Breedlove, certainly added to your luster with their racing successes for the AMX and the Javelin, gave you an image that was really exciting for the late '60s. I think.
Oh, it was really what we'd looked for, and the AMX added quite a lot to it because we just it's a make from the Javelin,
mm-hmm, right.
But we did enough ingenious things with it, I guess you could say, so that it. It was a two-seater. It established itself as almost a different kind of a car.
Mm-hmm. And the same author quotes William S. Pickett at the time of the introduction. He was then the AMC sales vice president there. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of price, performance, and standard equipment, the AMX has an individual character of its own and should not be compared with any other car.
Well, nobody else was making, well, except maybe Corvette was making two-seater automobiles at that time, and certainly of that type, of that configuration.
What was your relation with Dick Teague during this decade? Did you work
personally
closely with him in terms of...
Dick and I were, we were together practically every day.
That's great.
Yeah. No, he's one of my close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And a tremendously talented guy. And, you know, and we shared not only the interest in what we were doing there, but also he was sort of our authority on antique automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And I was, I've never collected them. I've always been sort of interested in them.
Sure.
And so, Dick was a jewel.
He had to work, of course, though, with the awkward situation of not being able to come up with new automobiles from the ground
right.
up. You had to use
not
components.
Not having the money.
Not having the money, right.
Just that simple.
And so he became sort of a quick change artist in a way, where you used components from various lines.
Sure. Well, one perfect example being we made the Gremlin out of the Hornet, and I think the total tooling bill was like $6 million, and you couldn't
mm-hmm.
tool a left front, hell, you couldn't tool a bumper guard for that now.
Really?
And,
right.
and more than that, we got it, so we hit the market with this first, quote, subcompact before anybody else. And
mm-hmm.
well, Dick was tremendously competent that way. He sketched something out of the back of an envelope at lunch sometimes, and you know, he was that kind of a guy.
Mm-hmm. So he was just the man you needed. He was able to with great good humor and great talent, able to work in this rather awkward situation where little money and...
Well, I really think he enjoyed it.
I think he enjoyed
having to, you know, we'd sit down and talk about that, and we'd say, now, Dick, you know, you got $8 million or something to build a whole new automobile. And we'd kid one another about it. And we'd say, well, now, how can you go, you know, and utilize this and still have it look and feel like something new?
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a question of bending the sheet metal a little differently either. There were a lot of little aspects to it that he was a genius at it.
The MX really didn't quite, it had a lot of potential, but I think lack of money and lack of...
Well, we never had any big volume concepts
that's it,
for
yeah,
it. No,
right,
we figured we'd hit a segment of the market
yeah.
that, or you know, almost manufacture a segment of the market where,
right.
at that time, as I say, I think Corvette was the only person the only people making a two-seater
mm-hmm.
of that nature. I couldn't even remember what the quantity, what the volumes were, but
sure, yeah,
but it,
yeah.
but more importantly, it had an image, and that
fantastic.
Hell, we were doing. For what it cost us to adapt that from the Javelin, it was certainly worth it.
And the Penske team strove mightily to burnish up your racing image.
Well, then they were tremendously successful. You know, Roger is one of those fellows that he never misses a beat. He's
mm-hmm.
he's incredible.
He's still going strong.
Stronger than ever, I guess.
Yeah. And of course, you were coming up with bread and butter cars that you mentioned, the Hornet. The,
sure.
We were
selling Ambassadors and Matadors or whatever.
Right, right.
I'd forgotten what we called them at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, no, we still had a essentially full line of automobiles.
Mm-hmm. Dick is quoted in this article as saying that the Javelin always suffered, in my view, from its Rambler American heritage. It suffered a little bit from the dash axle arrangement. In other words, the wheel was too far back, and I always wanted a long hood. The only way on that chassis to get that longer hood was to add overhang, but obviously that couldn't work out. So, but the Javelin prevailed. It certainly was a fascinating automobile.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I know several people that still have theirs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then this article shows several of them are still being kept up by their original owners. What? So,
I better go back and read that book.
It's very good.
But you know, after 20 years, one's memory, and mine in particular, you could get it. You remember things that impressed you at the time, or
of course, and you sublimated a lot of the things as well, I'm sure. Tell us a little bit about Jerry Myers, who seems to be up and coming in this latter part of this decade.
Well, Jerry was really the guy in charge of Teague reported to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was responsible for all automotive development. I don't remember what title he had.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was probably executive vice president, but he was
mm-hmm.
sort of the, and as I recall it, manufacturing reported to him. And he had what you'd say they call the operating aspects. Now, finance and public relations and personnel and that sort of thing did not report to him.
Mm-hmm.
They, I guess they reported to Lunenburg mm-hmm. at the time. Well, finance reported to me, actually,
mm-hmm.
and international reported to me. We sort of, it's just typically the case in a company
yeah.
where you sort of divide it up depending on the attributes of whoever the people are that you got them running it.
Sure.
And they all the marketing all reported to Bill McNeely mm-hmm. at about that stage. I don't know just what year we're talking about here. And frankly, our hope, Bill Lunenburg's and mine, was that between both Myers and McNeely were tremendously capable people,
mm-hmm.
and each in their own way, each quite different. It was very similar, actually, to the Chapin Lunenburg combination.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bill didn't want anything to do with the outside. I mean, that was my problem. And
yeah.
I didn't want to try to run the plants.
Right.
Probably couldn't. Certainly not as well as he.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a mental picture that between the two of them, that we had another winning team.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked great as long as Bill and I were sitting there, sort of, I won't say telling them what to do, but refereeing it.
Sure. That's
and it. And I, to my eternal disappointment, when Bill and I left and it was turned over to them, essentially, it just didn't work. And I guess McNeely left first, and then Myers continued. Myers was a very, very forceful man.
Mm-hmm.
And McNeely left and had a couple of excellent jobs, one of which I was instrumental in, at least in referring him to them, and he never quite made it, put it together, and I regret to tell you that right now I don't even know where he is.
Really?
I don't mean to say that in a destructive way, because he's just disappeared out of my
orbit.
But interestingly enough, and I don't know if you noticed it, there's the cover of Fortune magazine of about a month ago. The picture of Scott McNeely, who was the head of, I guess it's Sun Electronics or something. He's the flaming success in the electronics business, and that's Bill's son.
Bill
McNeely's son.
Yeah, who was present when Myers was
chairman, I guess
chairman
the way it was,
yeah. That's interesting. One last, in the last 15 or 20 minutes, we have I'm fascinated by this AMX 3 2. Did that, let me read you a bit what I'm thinking of. Myers thought that it was time for a blockbuster type of image car. And what could be better than a mid-engine American sports car? As a starting point, Myers and Teague visited that year's Geneva show. This is in 1968. And then traveled to Italy, where Myers commissioned Giugiaro to prepare a styling prototype to compete against a proposal prepared by the AMC's own styling department. Do you remember that episode?
Well, I mean, that's a fairly standard thing you do.
Of course.
Go outside and have somebody do one, you do one internally, and then you try to run a clinic or something, decide which. Well, anyway, I remember distinctly the automobile, because I went over to... we finally got it, and you know, we had a prototype in running condition, we got BMW to do the engineering development work for us,
mm-hmm.
and I went to Munich and drove the car.
What'd you think?
It was a spectacular automobile,
mm-hmm.
and we had the budget all put together, and I came back, and Bill and I sat down and looked at it, and this was just at what we conceived to be the end of the muscle car era,
mm-hmm.
and. And we had, I think, three, maybe four of them built. And one of the guys that worked for Teague, for example, was driving out to Bloomfield, and he went over a manhole that was raised off the pavement by about an inch and a half, and tore the whole muffler system and maybe half the rear end out of it. I mean, it had clearance. It was there were aspects of it that were, and it was a lie down and drive kind of a car.
Right.
And it was a hell of a car. I mean, uh-huh. as I say, I really got a tremendous kick out of driving it in Europe.
Uh-huh.
But one thing led to another, and the more we looked at it, the more we thought, you know, this is exciting, but maybe we might get 20,000 units a year. We had the price and the volume and all the rest of it all thought through, mm-hmm. or at least we thought we did. Mm-hmm. And finally we just said, look, we're bucking the trend. The world is headed towards some kind of oil shortages, gasoline rationing, and we were absolutely right, as it turned out, because mm-hmm. we wouldn't have had the car till 1972 or something like that.
Right,
yeah. And so we shelved it.
You've been working with Bizzarrini and consulting with BMW. BMW did the body for you.
No, they did the engine, the mechanical. They put the mechanicals together.
Right.
Because it was one of our engine, and I've forgotten who the drivetrain made by, but it was an assembled automobile initially.
At this point, also in 1970, Myers and Tiger quoted as being interested in having Karmann do the bodies for the AMX3. Was there a problem with the price, or the price of the car as it would have to go up to make any money on it?
Well, I'm sure that was a consideration, but if there was a basic decision, basic motivation, it was the question of the trend is going to be all in the other direction was our mm-hmm. conclusion.
Yeah.
The muscle car era, it was going to end,
yeah.
and we had enough troubles with that. I shouldn't put it that way. We were doing fine. We just concluded it did not suit our future prospects because we didn't think it suited the future market.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned three. This article mentions that there were five main.
Were there five? I said three, four. I really forgot.
Interesting footnote to this. I wonder if you know this. Last spring, this was in '80. Teague discovered that just 10 miles from Torino, owned by Mr. Diamante, who had acquired the AMX3 components from a subcontractor to Bizzarrini and had put one together.
No kidding. I never heard that.
Yeah. He said he had to scrap four incomplete shells, in order to have a complete AMX3 body. To do so, he told Teague, pained his heart. Teague says, I have no regrets about the fact that he kept the car. In fact, I'm delighted he did so, because it's the fairest one of all. It's really a gem.
Dick had one himself for a while.
That's right. I think he still does.
It may still.
Yeah. When he left American Motors, I talked to him and then talked to him later. I think he was taking it with him. He didn't want to part with it.
Mm-hmm.
Dick said those were the Camelot years for him. He felt those were the most exciting times that he had working with you and with Lundeberg and with Myers. And he said it was a great time for him.
Well, it was an exciting time for all of us, you bet.
So in 70, you get back to, you pull the styling department back to reality, to bread and butter cars. How did this, just give us a quick glance ahead to our next interview. How did the 70s look to you at this point? How was your financial situation? Has it picked up a bit?
In the 70s?
Yeah.
I have to dig out my numbers, but we had, in 1970, we bought Jeep for one thing.
Right.
And it took us about a year and a half to really get that all coordinated, get our own engine in, and all those other things that we knew were going to make a hell of a difference.
Right.
And I think it was 72 or 73, we made, I think, 80-some million dollars, which was a lot of money in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I haven't looked up. I've got some of the old records here, but I haven't bothered to look them up. But we were doing hell of a lot better, and we had simplified our line to the point where we didn't have a vast variety of things, but we had a pretty representative line. And as I say, Jeep turned out to be a very real plus. And now it took a while for it to get going because Kaiser was losing money with it when we bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And but we saw all the prospective advantages that we could bring to it with what we already had. And so the 70s started out well. By about 75 or 6, it's terrible, I can't remember exactly what happened, what year, we got into some, we could see that the long range, we'd had what we call philosophy of seeking niches in the market where other people were not intensively competitive, where they had they either had a token of entry or they really didn't care about it. And we figured that we could find enough of those to keep us make a pretty nice business, that we weren't going to go head on with our then three competitors. Well, at that moment, really, Ford and GM were the things we worried about. And then bit by bit, I think we saw that that was really not going to be a viable long-term thing. And we knew that, that coming into this country, the technique of building a Toyota or a Nissan or, for that matter, a Volkswagen or a Renault is, you throw out all the U.S. stuff at all. Everything's different. The door handles are different from everything. You have to build to an entirely different scale. And you have to have engines that are suited to that. And we didn't have any of that. And there was no way we figured out we were going to be able to bring them in on our own, which is when we started looking for a partner. And I had been talking to Renault for a long time. And that was sort of what led up to the Renault thing.
Good. That's perfect. Let's stop right there.
Okay.